More than two-thirds of people in jail in the United States have not been found guilty of a crime. Instead, they're being held in pretrial detention because they were not able to pay a cash bail, which is used as a way to get them to show up for court dates. The system can have devastating consequences for low-income people, and now states across the country are working to change the cash bail system. I spoke with Kellen Funk, a professor at Columbia Law School, about problems with the cash bail system and efforts to make change. And I asked him first off how widespread the practice is.
So globally, it's not prevalent at all. Really, the United States is about the only nation that uses the practice, except for the Philippines, which is kind of a relic of colonialism. But within the United States, cash bail is very widespread. Basically, every jurisdiction uses it today, some to a greater extent than others. There are a couple states that do not allow commercial sureties to operate. So the defendant or the defendant's family and friends have to put up the money, but there's no sort of arm's length commercial transaction taking place.
Now, bail is set before someone is actually convicted of a crime. And that's an important point here because, as we mentioned at the top, there are people who are sitting in jail without having been convicted. And we know one of these here in New York is Rikers Island, right?
Yes.
Perhaps the most well-known case, or at least tragic case here in New York City, was that of Kalief Browder. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to Kalief? And do you see cases like this across the country?
So Kalief is actually a pretty typical story. He was arrested on the charge of stealing a backpack, a low-level felony that ultimately the prosecutors could not sustain. They could not find any witnesses to corroborate the evidence. So the short story is that the charge was ultimately dropped if it wasn't bogus from the get-go. But because Kalief refused to take a plea agreement because he wanted to contest the charge, he wanted to maintain his innocence, but he also could not pay what was actually a pretty low-level amount of bail, but he did not have that money to pay it. His family didn't have the money to pay it. He was incarcerated on Rikers Island for 3 years while the case was proceeding. And then I think, as most people know, just the violence and the trauma of that experience led to his suicide sometime after he was released from Rikers. As I say, this is a pretty typical story in the early stages in that, you know, many people experience this situation of wanting to contest a charge or even just wanting a better deal from the prosecutor, even if they are going to plead. But because they are unable to pay the bail amount in their case, they are incarcerated as if they've already been convicted. For however long it takes for the prosecutor to either prove the charges or dismiss the case,
which is it's almost unfathomable when you think about it. And because we're talking about money, and one of the interesting things about this show is we talk a lot about inequality. How does this play out across the country when it comes to economic inequality?
Well, I mean, there are so many examples we could look to. We could think of recent instances like Harvey Weinstein walking into court and walking out within an hour on $1 million bail, which to him is a drop in the bucket. And so you contrast these situations of someone who's able to walk into court of his own accord, pay an easily affordable amount and walk out versus those for whom even a small amount of bail, even $500, isn't immediately payable, can lead to a weekend in jail, can lead to lost employment, lost apartment leases, lost custody. Even if release happens, you know, within a week or so, it can still be extremely disruptive.
Judges know this. So why do judges persist in using this system? Judges know that Harvey Weinstein can afford to pay $1 million. Mm-hmm. Judges know that some other defendants probably can't pay $1 million or even $500, as you mentioned. So where are judges in all this?
I mean, it's complicated. There's a whole confluence of factors. I mean, for some local judges, judicial elections play a big role here, and local judges know that what matters most to their constituents are that dockets keep moving and are kept clear. There's not a huge backlog of cases. That crime control is proceeding apace. And so that means actually the sort of coerced pleas that come from the bail system are actually necessary to keep the system running along. That if they actually did hold a trial for each and every misdemeanor and low-level felony charge, the system would lock down forever.
There are efforts at reform. Let's talk about some of those. What are some of the different types of cash bail reform efforts you're seeing across the country that really stand out, that mm-hmm. really have a chance, if any, of making a difference here?
So there's kind of two major models right now. One is the New Jersey and New Mexico system, which does not entirely eliminate cash bail, but basically creates a hierarchy that judges have to think through, more or less on the record, you know, in writing, where they have to ask, you know, why wouldn't just outright releasing this person satisfy my sense of their risk of non-appearance or of committing a new crime during trial? And only if they can sort of articulate why release without conditions won't work, why release on some kind of non-financial condition, maybe periodic drug testing or check-in or something like that. You know, only after they work through a hierarchy of options can they come to cash bail. I think the reforms that show the most promise are those that put the procedural burdens on the courts and on the prosecutors to have to articulate in a timely manner, like, why this particular defendant needs to be incarcerated at such high cost to them and to the community, that this is the direction we have to go in. And if that burden is on the court and in prosecutors to do that in every single case, I think what you'll see is an emerging default that, well, we just need to release as many people as we can so that we can spend time thinking about the hard cases.
Kellen Funk is a professor of law at Columbia University Law School. Thank you for being with us, Kellen.
Thank you so much.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.